Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Hello and welcome. For those of you who are feeling a little cold nowadays, I want to remind you that there are other places in this country that are even more cold. So today I'm going to read stories about cold, ice, and snow, and winter. This first story is entitled Ice Delivery. It was no small task to keep the town chilled all year. This is written and sent in by Nolan Spencer. In the late 1930s, my parents, Ed and Verna Spencer, gave up farming and moved to Bagley, Minnesota, where they started Spencer Ice and Dray Company. Back in those days, household refrigerators were not common, and families relied on ice boxes to keep food cool and fresh. The ice part of the company supplied ice for those ice boxes. You may not be familiar with the dray part of the name. In those days, there were few semis on the highway and no UPS or FedEx. Things were moved from place to place by railroad and then had to be delivered to their final destinations. In the early years, this work was done by horse and wagon. Later, pickup trucks and flatbed trucks did the job. Foods, furniture, hardware, and equipment arrived at train depots, and draymen picked them up to deliver the items to the proper recipients. Draymen hauled coal from the depot to homes and businesses, moved furniture, and hauled trash to the dumping grounds. You name it, and a drayman had likely delivered it. Various things were also shipped out of town by train, and in that case, the drayman delivered them to the depot. Spencer Ice and Dray Company delivered stored lake ice to most of the homes, grocery stores, and taverns in town. Some of my earliest memories include riding in Dad's pea-green 1941 Chevy pickup delivering ice. A delivery at a tavern often resulted in a bottle of orange pop. Keeping Bagley's homes and businesses supplied with ice was no small task. With the assistance of Dad's younger brothers, Leroy and Lawrence Spencer, and Frank Scala and Bobby Colthorpe, a two-story roofless ice house was built on a large lot next to our home. It was constructed of peeled tamarack poles set deep into the earth. Rough pine boards from the local sawmill were nailed to the insides of these upright poles to form the walls. An opening was left on the street end for trucks to back in and unload sawdust, which formed the insulation for the ice. First, a thick layer went onto the bare ground. Then, as ice was hauled in from the frozen lake, interlayers of sawdust from the Wallingford sawmill were added. Sawdust was placed between the added ice and the inside of the walls. Finally, the topmost layer of ice cakes was also covered with a thick layer of sawdust. The ice was cut from nearby Lake Lomond in February. Dad and his crew would cut long slots in the ice using a 42-inch circular saw mounted on skids and powered by a Model A Ford car engine. This saw was used to cut long, narrow rows through the ice as one would cut a cake. The rig was then turned 90 degrees to make many more cuts for the cakes that would ultimately result. Since the powered saw could not cut through a full depth of the ice, which was 24 to 30 inches thick, T-handled ice saws were used by hand to complete the cuts to the water below. Ice chisels were used to break the cakes apart, resulting in ice blocks weighing approximately 300 pounds. A long slot, about the width of three cakes, was cut all the way to the shore. An engine-powered loading ramp was positioned with one end in the shallow water where several, next to the shore, cakes had been removed. This ramp's height could be adjusted, and it had two endless spike chains built into its bed. The flatbed delivery truck was backed down so that the top end of the ramp was on the top of the rear end of the truck bed. Cakes of cut ice were then pushed into position with spike-tipped pike poles, and the chain moved them up to the truck bed. The ice cakes were unloaded at the ice house and covered with sawdust. Surprisingly, the sawdust kept the ice from melting all summer long. As ice deliveries were requested through the year, the sawdust had to be hosed off the cakes. The large 300-pound cakes were most often chiseled into 25 or 50-pound cakes for home deliveries. They were hauled into homes with the cakes on the iceman's leather-covered shoulder using smaller ice tongs. There was another ice harvesting operation in town, and between the two, they managed to satisfy the town's needs until the next ice harvest rolled around in a year. Keep in mind that people used ice much more sparingly than we do now. No bags of cubes were available. My dad was a good marketer and had small free cards printed up to give to potential customers and as rewards. A pink card was good for 50 pounds of ice, while the light green one was good for 25 pounds. Dad and my mother, Verna, operated the ice and dray business until Dad joined the U.S. Army at age 33 in 1944. He was trained as a Sherman M4 tank driver at Fort Knox, Kentucky. He was headed to Okinawa in 1945 and would have been in the invasion of Japan. But the dropping of the two atomic bombs changed that. Instead, he was sent to the Philippines. There, he operated two huge diesel generators with the assistance of two Japanese prisoners. He was discharged in 1946. By that time, refrigerators had rendered ice delivery obsolete. So my parents used a GI loan to open a small general store just west of Bagley in 1947. Later, they added a mobile home court, but that's another story. I still use Dad's T-handled ice saw to cut holes in the ice for spearing northern pike. I use the smaller delivery tongs to remove the smaller ice blocks from the spearing hole. Although I will soon be 80, my fond memories of my parents' business remain as fresh in my mind as the cold, clean lake ice I helped deliver around town so many years ago. And there's a picture of Nolan with his mother, Verna Spencer, on the running board of the Spencer Ice and Dray Company's delivery truck. Well, that story certainly sent a chill up my spine. Here's another one that'll do the same thing. It's about snow. The story's entitled Economics by the Shovelful. Snow days meant cold cash for the ambitious boys. This is sent in by Harvey Silverman. Like every other kid growing up in New England, Worcester, Massachusetts in my case, in the 1950s, a snowstorm meant I was up early and sitting by the radio, listening to the no school announcements, waiting impatiently as the radio voice listed the school closures in alphabetic order. If my mom had tuned in a few moments too late, I faced the ordeal of listening to local news until the list came around again. A snow day was filled with glorious possibilities. Outside, we could sled, have snowball fights, and build snow forts and snowmen. Inside, there was daytime television, which we seldom got to see, on the small black-and-white screen. At the age of 10 in 1956, a snow day created another possibility. I became an entrepreneur and learned my first lessons about business and economics. My friend Mike and I had decided that at the next big snowstorm, we would answer opportunity's knock and earn some money by shoveling snow. At last, a storm had come, and even better, it was on a weekday when dads would be at work, thereby leaving the shoveling for somebody else. I phoned Mike, who was up, ready, and enthusiastic. After a hurried breakfast, I made my way through the deep snow of my backyard into his, snow shovel on my shoulder and thoughts of cold cash on my mind. Mike was already outside and shoveling the front walk of his next-door neighbor. I quickly made my way there and joined him. He told me that after I had called, he went out, rang the neighbor's doorbell, and secured the business. Our first job. As we happily shoveled away, I asked Mike how much we were getting paid for the job. 35 cents. 35 cents? That was all? The job had to be worth twice that, or at least 50 cents anyway, I thought. And how do we split 35 cents anyhow? First lesson, negotiate an agreement with your business associate and establish a fair price. After a short discussion, Mike was persuaded that perhaps the price he had quoted was on the low side, and we agreed that in the future we would determine a fair price, easily divided by two, before asking for the work. We continued to shovel with great energy. It was, after all, our first job. We produced a wide and clear path, and when we had finished, we went to the front door to collect our pay. Mrs. O'Brien looked out at our work and gave us a half dollar, since we had done such a good job, and she asked us to please come back at the next big storm. Second lesson, always do your best work. A happy customer is likely a repeat customer. We went from door to door seeking our next job. After a couple of rejections, we were hired again, finished the work, and received our pay. We remained enthusiastic, and off we went to find another customer. But by now, there were other kids out on the street looking for and securing shoveling work. We had competition. Now we were in a race for business. They were older, stronger, faster shovelers. We could tell by the tracks in the snow approaching front doors where they had already sought work. Jobs became more difficult to get. Luckily, we had been first on the street. Third lesson, start early. Be first with the product or service. We neared a house whose front walk had already been shoveled when a man, an adult, came out the front door and asked if we were looking for shoveling work. That was confusing. His walk was already shoveled. He explained that he had shoveled the walk himself, but was leaving immediately by taxi to go to his office, and he wanted his driveway shoveled so he could use his car tomorrow. I'll pay $5. The snow was deep, the driveway long and wide, the job daunting, but $5? We agreed. And so we shoveled, and shoveled, and shoveled some more. The fun part was gone. The energy waned. The enthusiasm dimmed. The piles of snow grew higher and higher. The driveway appeared to get longer and longer. We agreed this would be the last job of the day. We shoveled some more. Finally, we reached the end. We were done. We had turned to go back to the front door and collect our pay from the man's wife when we heard the ominous sound. The snowplow. The city's snowplow was making a new pass on the street, widening and cleaning up. We watched helplessly and hopelessly as it left a pile of heavy, dense snow along the curb in front of the driveway. More shoveling. We finally finished, collected our money, and headed home, too tired to even split it up. That could wait until tomorrow. Fourth lesson, Think through the job. Have realistic expectations. Don't take on a job you cannot finish. Anticipate unexpected difficulties. The remainder of the day was spent alternately prostrate, watching a bit of TV, reading comics, and generally doing nothing. But the next day after school, we met and split up our earnings. I had $3, three whole dollars. Fifth lesson. There is nothing wrong with hard work, especially when you get paid for it. Life has changed a lot since those days. Snowblowers have decreased the need for hiring snow shovelers. Landscapers put plows on their trucks to earn wintertime money. There's no longer a rush of kids out looking for shoveling jobs. Sixth lesson, markets change. A couple of years later, Mike and his family moved away. Despite the typical promises, we lost touch in a year or two. Serendipitously, after several decades, I reconnected with Mike. He has had a happy and successful life, as have I. We reminisced about our shoveling exploits and our shared and happy childhood adventures. It was wonderful to see him again. Final lesson, friendship is priceless. This was Economics by the Shovelful by Harvey Silverman. This next winter story is entitled After the Cotton. The field work was done, but other duties called. This was sent in by Carlene Poff Baker. The school term for children in the cotton farming communities of the Delta Flatlands of Arkansas back in the 1940s was called a split term. School let out at the end of May, and between that time and the 1st of July, we hoed cotton in our family's fields. We started a school the next term around mid-July. Then school was closed at the end of August when the matured cotton stalks were loaded with open balls of white fluff begging to be harvested. We garbed our young shoulders with pick sacks and began the daily sunup to sunset task of gathering the cotton. We resumed school attendance after Labor Day and stayed steadily until the end of May, except for 2 days for Thanksgiving and 2 whole weeks for Christmas. However, we were not totally free of the cotton patch until all of the bollies, or scraps, had been gleaned from all the stalks. Every day until after Christmas, as soon as we got home from school, we put on our farming clothes and worked until dark. Of course, we didn't work in rainy, sleety, or snowy weather. I remember sitting at my desk at school and looking out the window at the sky, wishing for the sleet or snow to fall. Christmas was the year's grand finale. We celebrated with gifts to and from each other, extended family get-togethers, and delicious foods prepared from handed-down recipes. After Christmas, we girls hung up our pick sacks, realizing we would not have to do any field work until spring, when we would start chopping again. Daddy worked at the gin and trapped and hunted for our winter meat. He sold his trapping furs. These meager funds kept us going financially until spring, when Daddy again got his furnish money to begin another crop. Long winter nights after our chores, hand-washing dishes, pumping night water, churning to make butter, and school homework, we listened to the battery radio, sat in front of the warm morning heating stove, and read, played games around the kitchen table, or made chocolate fudge or parched peanuts. Wash day was rough those winter days, hand pumping a barrel of water and later breaking ice off the top and carrying it to the wash pot was tough. But the worst part was hanging out those clothes. They often froze before they could be pinned on the line. After using the water pump, we had to be sure to let it lose its prime before leaving it so that it would not freeze. Then, to prime it again when water was needed, The one pumping would pour lukewarm water into its top and pump vigorously to get the water up and flowing. We slept warm with heated flat irons wrapped in flannel at our feet between folded over double blankets and mountains of quilts on top of us. Getting up mornings was a shivering experience. Daddy would have already gotten up and built the fire. Hearing Mom clanging pots and pans in the kitchen and the crackling of the fire in the living room, we would dash out of bed and run to the fire. Careful not to trip over the turned-up linoleum edges or step in snow that might have sifted in around the windows, we took turns dressing behind the stove. After a warm breakfast, we went out on the back porch, broke the ice in the water bucket, dipped out water in a glass, and then brushed our teeth, rinsing our mouths in that icy water. Back inside, we put on our heavy coats and other wrappings, and then we dashed out the door on our hurried walk to the schoolhouse, focusing on cozying up to another pot-bellied stove with a crackling fire that awaited us at school. At recess, we skated on the frozen pond, no skates, just the soles of our shoes, or played basketball on the open court. On snowy days, we built snowmen or forts or igloos, and of course had snowball fights. Hog butchering was a special social event in the winter. Hog owners had to pick bitterly cold days to slaughter so that the meat would not spoil before it had been worked up. Neighborhood men and their wives gathered to do this bloody job. Men slaughtered, scaled, scraped, and cut up the pork. The women ground chunks of meat into sage sausage, salted down hams and bacon, and made hogshead cheese. I knew for sure that the next week or two after this event, our menus would consist of all sorts of fresh pork, most of which I did not like, such as the feet, ears, tail, tongue, liver, heart, brains. Ugh! Our family went to church every Sunday during winter, but the services started later, recessed at noon for lunch at the church, and then resumed after eating for another hour. By then, the shorter days were getting colder, and after dismissal, everyone scattered to their wagons with the empty pails that had held their foodstuffs to get home before dark. Occasionally, two or three families would meet at one home to listen to the radio, especially when the Jack Benny program or Fibber McGee and Molly or some other comic show was on. The grown-ups would play checkers or dominoes, and we kids would color or play paper dolls on the floor. Sometimes the ladies would make rabbit meat hot tamales using our shucked corn husks for wrappers. Everyone would scamper to their homes when we kids were either yawning a lot or were sprawled around on the floor sound asleep. Winter was indeed long back then, from mid-October to the first dove cooing of spring in the Delta flatlands of Arkansas. But there were so many delightful things attached to that time of year. Recalling those winters, I believe it was sharing them with the people I love best that made those cold days and nights, some of the good old days, I will always hold sacred in my heart. This was After the Cotton by Carlene Puff Baker. Here's a couple of winter stories from the bits and pieces section of the good old days. This first one's entitled Under the Ice. When I look back at the things I did as a kid, it's a wonder I'm still alive today. The park in our small town had a pond that filled with water when it rained hard, but the pond had a leak, so the water would soon drain out. However, sometimes in the winter, it would rain hard and the pond would fill up, but the water on the surface would turn to thick ice, and then only the water underneath would drain out as usual. In some places, this ice would cave in and create an opening for us kids to get under the ice. We could walk around on the dry bottom of the pond and see other kids playing on the ice above us. Did our parents know about this? Absolutely not. Would they have forbidden us to get near that ice if they had known?
Probably yes.
Would the ice have broken a lot of bones, or worse, if it had collapsed on us?
No question.
Now that a lot of years have passed, I'm glad that my parents and all my friends' parents never knew about some of the things we did, and I'm glad they were not overprotective about the things they did not know about. If they had known, and if they had been overprotective, a lot of the good memories of my childhood would be missing. This was Under the Ice by John Ziegler. Now this story, entitled Just for Fun. My best years of outdoor adventure occurred in a mid-sized community in northern Minnesota. Our family had moved to Moorhead in 1959 when I was 10, and I formed lifelong memories of social recreation there. My school was just across the street from our home. That immediate access meant that I quickly made friends with other neighborhood children who also walked to and from school. We drummed up many plans. In cold, snowy Minnesota winters, we skated. The ice rink and warming house were just 3 blocks from home. Friends and I made plans at the end of the school day to skate in the evening after dinner. Our parents allowed us to walk to the rink at night as a group without escort. We bundled into parkas with our skates on long laces slung over our shoulders. Then, under the streetlights, we headed to the outdoor ice rink for our fun. Because of the intense cold, our outings were quite brief. The sense of freedom, however, has remained with me my entire life. This story was entitled Just for Fun and was sent in by Margaret Brinton. Well, I don't know about you, but after all those cold stories, I think I'm going to go out and put on a heavier jacket. At any rate, you've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories today.